Good evening, James McCanny here with my Science Hour. This for July 25th, 2019. Many topics to cover tonight, including a number of comet topics. And, of course, last week I want to do a little review of my interview last week with Mark Gaffney, give some follow-up points. If you have not listened to that interview, you know, I rarely do interviews on this show, but I did last week, so make sure you listen to the last week's show, that'd be the 18th of July, where I did the whole show interview with Mark Gaffney on the location of the old North Pole. So I'll be doing some follow-up information on that. First of all, there's a comet called Comet K2. Its designation is C2017K2. That's the official comet name. And it's coming in from way beyond the solar system. We don't know if it's a first-time visitor, but it's the farthest comet ever discovered in history. Now, I believe it was the Great Comet of, like, 1861, which was discovered beyond Saturn. And this comet was discovered much farther than that, which, of course, is a mystery to astronomers. They can't really explain it, so they kind of dig deep into their bag of tricks into their rabbit hat to bring out an explanation. And so they think that this comet, according to their dirty snowball comet model, is coming in from distant outer space, and the cold, the nucleus, that volatiles that are very volatile are sublimating off the nucleus and causing the display that they're seeing. So this thing, now they make an estimate that the coma, which is the gas cloud around the nucleus, is around 80,000 miles. And they make an estimate that the nucleus is around 12 miles across, which would actually be pretty big for comets. Like Halley's Comet, the nucleus was about 7 miles across, and that was actually measured nose to nose, so they really know that well. But 12 miles would be relatively big. Hale-Bopp, they said, was around 42 miles across, but the reality was that Hale-Bopp was Earth-sized. The nucleus was Earth-sized, and it was a planet in formation. If you want to learn more about Hale-Bopp, go to my DVD. It's downloadable on my webpage in the book section. Just go to the sales page, go down the eDVD. Dealing with Hale-Bopp, the 20th anniversary of Hale-Bopp, which it was discovered in July 23rd, actually about a day ago, 2 days ago, in 1995. And in 2015, I had a 20th anniversary DVD that I produced all about Hale-Bopp. And so anyway, and for you Planet X aficionados out there, people that are wondering whatever happened to the topic of Planet X, well, it kind of fell off the edge of the Earth, of the flat Earth. All of the disinformation out there that was promulgated because of Hale-Bopp and about the Planet X topic, well, it turns out that, remember Robert Harrington, Naval Observatory, the head of the Naval Observatory, who studied Planet X under a contract with NASA and actually discovered it, he discovered the nucleus of Hale-Bopp way down in the southern part of the solar system. And it had a companion, so he was able to determine the mass and also determine its orbit, and it was on a very near collision course with Earth at the time. Then the tail drag slowed it down, and eventually it missed us by about 3 months. Earth had moved ahead 3 months in its orbit, and so it was a non-issue. But if Earth would have been in that location in Earth's orbit when Hale-Bopp passed through the ecliptic, which is the plane of the planets, we would have been a mere 1 million miles or 4 lunar distances from the nucleus, and that was a big comet. So it's not like the nucleus would have been that close, but we would have been immersed in the coma. And that's reminiscent of the Noah's flood. tremendous influx of water at a given time, worldwide torrential rains pouring out of the heavens. And so we might be a very different planet at this point in time. But of course, there's a long involved story with that, so I'm not going to go into that here. But Comet K2, on the other hand, its orbit will take it outside of the orbit of Mars. Now, this is very interesting because I've analyzed this, and even if its orbit changed considerably, as did the orbit of Hale-Bopp, there's no indication that it's going to somehow affect planet Earth. And so these things are very difficult to plan or to forecast, because the understanding of tail drag, which is, of course, one of the properties that I deal with in the plasma discharge comet model, the tail drag changes the orbit. The bigger the comet, the larger the tail drag. And it's kind of an interesting effect in that Hale-Bopp had its orbit changed tremendously, whereas a small comet like Halley's had its orbit changed relatively little. And so anyway, not going to go into all of that detail, but in the incorrect high priest of astronomy tier 2, by the way, Dirty Snowball Comet model, they claim that the jetting material coming off the nucleus is what changes the comet's orbit, because comets are notorious for having their orbits change. But the only problem is, when you get close to a comet, there's nothing coming off the nucleus, which was proven by the European Space Agency with their Rosetta mission to Comet 67P. But anyway, Comet K2, as it stands, will be coming in, and it might be visible. It might be visible to the naked eye, but there's a lot of considerations that have to happen. The orbit of this comet probably will change. So trying to make an estimate of where you will be, say you're in the state of Kansas, and Kansas comes around, you know, given the orbit that the comet has right now, you might be in a certain position with the night sky, etc., on a given date when the comet comes through, passes through the ecliptic, etc. But given that the comet orbit for Comet K2 will change, it might be totally different. So it's hard to predict. At this point, we'll have to wait, and I guess the closest approach is going to be in the year 2022. So quite a few years away. A lot can happen between now and then. But I suspect that the orbit is going to change. At the current time, the orbit of this comet puts it outside the orbit of Mars, so quite a distance away. And we might be able to see this with the naked eye. Original estimates of brightening based on past prior comet brightening patterns indicate that you probably won't be able to see this comet with the naked eye. But that could change. All of this could change. So anyway, the people wrote in asking about what's going on with Comet K2. It's something I will update you as time goes on. Every now and then, pop into a show and give you a little current information. So the jury is certainly still out on this one. And it will be interesting also to see if we have any sunward spike activity with this comet, seeing as to how it's very big. It's going to be a big comet. And by the way, the 12-mile-wide nucleus estimate that the boys at NASA are making is secondary, tertiary information. In other words, they make a measurement of one kind, and then they make an estimate with another instrument, or maybe make some back-of-the-envelope type of calculation estimates, and that's where they're coming up with this number. It is not, I repeat, it is not a measured number. The size of the coma should be fairly accurate, 80,000 miles across, but the size of the nucleus is an estimate, and it could be really big. In fact, It was originally discovered, or the earliest photograph, let me put it this way, it was originally discovered and then photographed with the Hubble Space Telescope in the year 2017, thus its designation C2017K2. But they went back in photographs of other telescopes of that region of the sky and, in fact, found this comet in prior photographs going back to 2013, which put it way, 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 way out beyond Saturn. In other words, really the farthest comet ever discovered in history, and with the prognostication that it will be considerably large. It will be a large comet. So we'll be keeping an eye on this for you, and when the time arises, we'll be giving you new updates. And so one thing also is that I've kept the ephemeris from this, because that's something that, with the comet Hale-Bopp, the Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics and Astronomy kept changing the ephemeris for Hale-Bopp as it changed, because Brian Marsden, who now deceased, was the head of that agency, which catalogs asteroid and comet data and gives them their designation, their names. Stated when they first saw Hale-Bopp that it was very big and it would not have any orbital changes. Then it turned out that not only was Comet Hale-Bopp really big, it was really, really big. And therefore, according to the jetting theory of the Dirty Snowball Comet model, should not have had any orbital changing at all. And it had a orbital change that was noticeable on a daily basis. So Brian Marsden had to eat his words on that. And that, the whole history of Hale-Bopp, like I say, you have to go listen to my DVD on that topic because it's very complicated. And to understand that Hale-Bopp was the nucleus of the, literally, the Planet X object discovered by Robert Harrington at the Naval Observatory. Okay. The last week had the big celebration of NASA 50-year anniversary, go to the moon thing. And as I'll just repeat for the record, and it's posted on my webpage, is that this moon landing thing is an unverified scientific claim. Here are the criteria for something to be scientifically verified. It has to be repeatable. It has to be something that other people can repeat. It has to be documented. In other words, the person doing the experiment or making the scientific claim has to maintain records, which NASA has not done. They have destroyed all of the records of the Apollo program. And nothing is left for us to investigate to see how they did this magical event of sending six different spacecraft to the moon and landing and having 18 people go to the moon, 12 of them allegedly walking around on the moon. But they don't have a single record of this process, of the process that allowed them to go to the moon. Rocket design, rocket engine designs. They dismantled the Saturn V rocket, literally the biggest rocket ever to go off of a launch pad on Earth. And they dismantled it all. Well, some interesting things are coming out about this recently, but let me just complete the science. If it's a scientific claim, here are the three things you need. It has to be documented. It has to be verified by third-party independent groups or individuals, and it has to be repeatable. And the moon landing is none of these, in spite of the immense amount of hoopla in jumping up and down and beating on drums. It does not pass any of the three criteria for a scientific achievement. Okay, but be that as it may, we'll just leave it at that. But the real question is here, they have squandered 50 years of our space endeavor, producing literally nothing of value for you, the public. The next thing is that they now want to go to the moon. They don't want to go to the moon. Well, when Trump recently had Buzz Aldrin, who was can't even hold a sentence. I saw an interview, I forget, I did one of these ladies on the evening news interviewing Buzz Aldrin. I mean, he couldn't even form a sentence. He couldn't hold a thought. He just rambled from one thing. And she was having a tough time, like, reeling this guy in to get some kind of coherent answer out of him. So she resorted to yes or no questions that would warrant a yes or no answer. And he would just wander off into Never Never Land. And so finally she goes, well, thank you very much, and shut him off. And you could see the look on her face, like, this guy is an astronaut. This guy can't even form a sentence. But Buzz had a little problem with alcohol after the space program. And anyway, be that as it may, the real issue is they cannot go to the moon or Mars today. They're making all kinds of grandiose plans about having a space station orbiting the moon, and it then going out, and people will stay on the space station. Then they will land on the moon. I mean, all of this stuff that they're talking about is so far from any reality of what they have been able to accomplish. It's just Looney Tune. So they're talking about going back to the moon in 2024. I got news for you. They couldn't get a mouse in orbit by 2024. They'll be lucky to get a mouse in orbit around Earth, let alone go to the moon. And they certainly aren't going to Mars. I talked about this a number of weeks ago, that all of the things that you have to do and be to go to Mars, not the least of which is have people in weightlessness for a period of well over 3 years. And somebody wrote in, they said, well, doesn't Mars have gravity? Well, yeah, it does. But the majority of time you're going to be in a spacecraft in a gravitationless environment. And Mars has a very low surface gravity compared to Earth. So it's one of the big issues is being weightless in space for that long. Nobody has ever been in space for that long weightless. So, I mean, they're, you know, taking all your food for a three-year period without being able to supply from planet Earth. I mean, they are so far away from even doing one aspect of going to Mars that it's not funny. So to think they're going to somehow go to Mars in even 20 years is ridiculous. They have to have had by now a lot of experience in, you know, food storage, radiation protection, which is a huge issue that they don't know anything about, have no solutions. Micrometeorite bombardment on a spacecraft that's, you know, just the list goes on and on and on. All the technical issues of machines and, you know, the landing craft and taking propulsion chemicals with them and storing them. And propulsion chemicals have problems like cooling and, you know, composition, auto composition of the chemicals. It just goes, the list goes on and on and on. So there, you know, and that was one of the problems with the original moon landing, is there were hundreds of systems, all of which had to work properly, and they simply didn't have the technology. You could go down the list from batteries to, you know, the whole laundry list of things that they just didn't have the technology to go to the moon in 100 ways, not just one or two. So anyway, the real issue here is the wasting of our national resources for space by an agency that is completely incompetent, which has not accomplished anything and will not accomplish anything. We've already wasted 50 years with this bunch of goofballs, and now we're supposed to sit back and wait for another 20 years for them to put one guy on Mars or three or five or whatever. No, this is absurd. This is absurd. Anyway, okay, jumping off that topic. A listener wrote in this week, and I took a look at this, and I was a little bit surprised, but it has to deal with sunspot data. And this is from the SILO a project, the Record of Sunspots. and they have given the alleged sunspot numbers for the past 13 years, and then they're doing a forecast because we're heading into the solar minimum with literally no sunspots, I think, for about 60 days now. And so the listener pointed out that the number of sunspots through the years 2010 to 2018, literally, where it went from solar minimum up through solar maximum, rising to solar maximum a little like early in the year 2014, and then dropping down again, that they literally have falsified the sunspot counts. And I've been on radio shows dealing with sunspots counts, and yes, they have falsified the data. This is absolutely absurd. Absolutely absurd. I see that on the graph here, they don't show, and this is one thing that happened in the mid 2000 to, well, about 2002 to 2008, during that solar maximum, we had no sunspots for a period of about 6 years. Literally, no sunspot day after day after day for many years in a row. So anyway, in that time period, they're showing sunspot counts, which is once again absurd. So interestingly enough, here in 2012 and then 2014, they're showing a double peak, which is what happened in the previous solar maximum, which was the early 2000s. But falsifying sunspot records. What is the deal? I'm just somewhat shocked and amazed. This is the Royal Observatory of Belgium. This is where the data is coming from. SILSO, actually, S-I-L-S-O. Now, I made an announcement a number of weeks ago. Remember that, what was it? Maybe about a year ago. There was a solar observatory in Arizona that they came in. We don't really know who. They were federal agents. They came in. They flushed everybody out of the solar observatory and made them go all home for a number of days. Claimed that the reason that they were doing this was because some employee had child pornography or something at his desk. And they did not inform the local sheriff. And so he was totally out of the loop here. And so anyway, their reason does not hold up. If that were the case, they would have notified the local police and the police would have gone in and arrested the guy at his desk, called him out, and that would be the end of it. They wouldn't shut down a solar monitoring facility for 3 days and make everybody go home over this alleged, crime that they discovered at the site. So something else was going on there. But at the time when this went on, we weren't even aware that this facility was still operating. And there's about 50 solar observatory sites around the world, many of them funded by the United States. And we have not been able to get data from any of these sites for, probably at least a decade. I have confidence that they're still up and operating. Also, I'll talk about weather reporting information. That the satellite data that you can find online has been greatly reduced, it's greatly filtered, and there's really no good weather data available. I'm not talking about weatherman who reads the news. There's plenty of that baloney around. But the actual data that I could look at to determine if hurricanes are manipulated or whatever was simply not there. It's simply been taken away. And the weather control is, the control of weather information, I should say, has skyrocketed. It's beyond the pale at this point. So there's no good information for the public to see to determine either space weather or earth weather, etc. Here's a topic that I just saw a video of surfing the internet, and there's a guy named David Berlinski. He wrote a book. What was the topic? Something like the devil's Let me just quick look at my notes here. Okay, I found it here. I'm going to quick pull this up. And the book is called, this is once again David Berlinski. The book is called The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. And of course, what he's talking about in his book is the fact that science has basically atheism as its basis. So if you look at the Big Bang or evolution or just on and on, there's very little scientific evidence, real scientific evidence, for these overreaching theories. And I talk about that in my book, The Diamond Principle, which was published at least a decade ago, where I talk about this very topic, that science is, the way it's taught today, the way it's presented, is primarily atheistic. And in the, say, in the schools, if you're, you know, they don't talk about individuals or beings or personas being individuals. According to science, you're just a little bit smarter monkey than the ones out there in the jungle yet. And so that's the way science is taught. And so the idea that there is no divine creator or divine plan, etc., evolution, whether it's in the evolution of the cosmos or evolution of the species, hits in the same vein, that God is not necessary. And of course, in my book, The Diamond Principle, I say the exact opposite. And in fact, one of the last times I was on Coast to Coast AM is when I presented that book. I had previously released all my books on Coast to Coast AM. But on that show, they had a guy named Howard Bloom, who is a NASA, you know, defendant or defending mouthpiece, apologist for NASA, trying to say how wonderful NASA was and how they had done all these things. And within that same week, they had a ghost-written book supposedly authored by Stephen Hawking, stating or putting words in Hawking's mouth that the same idea, that there was no need for a God. And of course, at that point, Hawking was completely incapacitated, if not already dead. So the idea was that they were countering my book, The Diamond Principle, with a book that was ghostwritten for Stephen Hawking. And the real story for Stephen Hawking, I've talked about this before, is that in his last book, which we know he wrote, the very last page, the very last sentences he talked about were what an incredible feeling it was for a scientist to discover a secret of nature, and in other words, discovering part of the grand design of the designer. And that was a great accomplishment of man, able to understand, you know, unlike an ape or a dog or a cat or a piece of seaweed, which does not have the ability to understand and reason and come to conclusions and look at the stars and wonder how things are made, that man is something very special. Because if you were just a little bit smarter monkey, well, maybe you'd, you know, be able to construct a little bit better hut out of bamboo or something. But there's a lot more going on here. And so something that I've talked about is the spirit of people, literally the spirit that lives inside the body of people. So here's a book, it's very interesting, The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions, David Berlinski. And I saw an interview with him where he's talking about these topics and how little evidence there is for things like evolution. It's on a fine, delicate, thin silk fiber, all of this science. And there's really, if you look at it, there's no evidence. And by default, there can be no evidence for evolution, because at the point where man evolved from something else, we weren't there. The intelligent man was not there to witness it. So all you can do is depend on, you know, interpretation of secondary data, and there's so many other missing pieces to the puzzle. And most of all, it doesn't explain what we see today. But anyway, just a comment on that. So, in fact, John Moore asked me when I was on his show yesterday morning as a guest. Well, I'm a guest with John Moore every Wednesday morning, if you're not aware of that. The Liberty Man on Republic Broadcasting. And John asked me, what would be the first book that somebody should read of my 11 books and all of my DVDs and CDs, etc.? What would be the first book people should read? And I said, The Diamond Principle, because I go through a summary of all of the prior books up to that point, and then I go into some broad paintbrush analysis of modern society, and especially modern science, and the idea of space travel and where man is today technologically, but more so socially and spiritually, and that those are the things that really count. You know, when NASA wants to go to the moon, they talk about the technical part and building machines and rocket engines that are bigger. Well, that's going to maybe get you a little ways in outer space, but the modern man does not have the wherewithal psychologically or socially or in the development of the human race, in the, you know, just the understanding of the universe and the appreciation of a design creation, a divine creation. And the something that I learned in my scientific studies is that things in nature are pretty easy, but you have to be connected into the universe, and you don't get this connection by reading a physics book or an advanced physics book or an advanced calculus or tensor analysis book. You don't get that from studying with your nose in a book. You get that by going out and living and sensing the world around you. It's a totally different educational process. Okay, so anyway, jumping back to the last week's interview with Mark Gaffney. Now, as I said, Mark and I have known each other for a long time. We were going to discuss how Mark and I met. In fact, we've never been in the same room or possibly even city together, but we've communicated over the years. And here's a little caveat so you understand how Mark Gaffney and I first met. There was an article claiming that something about NASA's dirty snowball comet model and then criticizing me. And so Mark wrote an article, very well researched, etc., and the name of the article was Dirty Snowball in Hell. And so it was basically a slam on the NASA Dirty Snowball Comet model. Well, he posted it on a blog page and then was immediately censored from that blog page. This is long before YouTube or Facebook censoring or YouTube or Google censoring. This is a long time ago. We're probably at least 10 years ago, probably more. And then also... when my books appeared on Amazon, the people started selling my books. So I don't sell on Amazon, never have, never will. And so Mark wrote an article in there about my books, you know, how they have these, a blog down below, your opinion of the books, etc. So Mark wrote a comment down there and at the very end said, don't buy your books of McCanny's books on Amazon. Get them directly from McCanny because, you know, he does not sell on Amazon. So anyway, those are some of the initial contacts I had with Mark. And so we've written back and forth about archaeology. Mark is an amateur archaeologist, amateur in the sense that he's not getting paid for it. And then also I would be classified also as an amateur archaeologist, spent much of my life crawling around ruins in the middle of the jungle doing surveying work, etc. But we've gone back and forth on this idea of the old North Pole. That's one of the topics we communicated on over the past, I don't know, like I say, I don't even know. I can't put a date on when we first started communicating. But it's good to have people like this on a higher plane, on an intelligent level, that really understand issues and are not biased by the, you know, an education that was filled with misinformation. So anyway, Mark took this topic recently, and he traveled to Egypt. He's traveled around the world. He's gone to South America, to Peru, a place that I've been in the recent years also, to Mexico, other places, and looked at the ruins and studied their orientation, etc., and also looking into natural phenomena that, for example, just an example is reef bed that have changed. They've moved like 1,200 miles all of a sudden at a certain point in history. The reef and all of the reef life moved overnight to reestablish at another location. And reefs are very temperature dependent, so that would imply a pole shift. Mark was looking into this. He kind of grabbed this topic by the horns and was basically studying it, and then is in the process right now of writing an extensive book. So I posted his one short paper on my webpage. It's there now. We've re-edited that page. And so if you went and looked at it before, it's been re-edited. I would suggest you go back and look at it again. It looks much different. Basically, the same content is there. But just scroll down a little bit. You'll find the link on my webpage. Scroll down. It's more like the third or fourth link there from the top of my webpage, jmccsci.com, and read that and then listen to the radio show of last week. So now I want to follow up with a bit of commentary. When you first hear the idea of a pole shift, and by the way, we're changing that to crustal deformation. In other words, a deformation of the crust, because a pole shift implies that the entire Earth just kind of moves and there's all of a sudden a new rotational pole. But a lot more happens in terms of the dynamics of how the Earth basically gets smashed. The Earth's surface gets smashed together. And this is basically due to a gravitational wave that comes in the Earth. It's like a tidal wave. It's just like the moon that moves over the Earth, or actually physically what happens is the Earth is rotating underneath the moon on a daily basis, and so twice a day, any given point on the Earth's surface falls underneath the moon. And when it does, the extra gravitational pull of the moon causes a tidal bulge. When that happens, the tidal bulge follows the moon. So as the Earth spins on a 24-hour basis, the tidal bulge follows the moon, and therefore creates what we call the tide. So the Earth's oceans bulge out, and when that bulge comes in towards the land, then the tide or the ocean level rises, and then it falls again, and this happens twice a day. On the far side of the moon from Earth, there is a lack of gravity. There's lesser gravity due to the moon than on the close side, so that creates a bulge on that side of the Earth. So you get a bulge on both sides of the Earth. So we get tidal action, a rise and fall twice per day in any given area. In some places, the Bay of Fundy is one of the highest regions of bulge. And at the same time, the surface of the Earth bulges by about an inch. Instead of 12 or 15 feet at certain places, or as little in some cases, a number of feet, the Earth's crust rises and falls maybe by a centimeter or an inch, depending on the area, maybe an inch and a half. But that's the same principle as a large celestial object coming by Earth. And if it comes by fast enough, I have lectures on all the different factors that affect the gravitational wave that goes into the surface of the Earth, the velocity of the object coming by, which gives you a greater impulse if the velocity is higher, or at the proximity of the object. If it's closer to Earth, you're going to get a bigger impulse. And if it's really close, you're going to get a tremendous impulse. So if two celestial objects pass by, then Earth is going to get a jolt primarily in the surface. And that can, the Earth's surface, if you understand the composition of the Earth, there's a viscous layer between the Earth's mantle crust and then the inner part of the Earth that's molten. So when that gravitational wave hits the surface of the Earth, that's where the bulging occurs, and the entire surface of the Earth can slide over the inner part. All of this, of course, is rotating at the same time. So I go through the dynamics of this in my pamphlet. It's called Surviving Planet X Passage. Many of you have this little pamphlet. It's the second book in the series, the first book being Planet X Comets and Earth Changes, in which I describe what comets are, that they're not dirty snowballs, that big comets can become planets, and they are attracting the material in the tail, not dispelling it away from the comet. And so it's really bizarre to see NASA scientists and standard astronomy scientists still talking about this. In fact, I'll read in a minute some of the experts, the excerpts of current commentary on this comet K2, just to show that they're still stuck in the cave ages. But the material is being drawn into the comet nucleus, and this material basically begins in atomic form, say hydrogen and oxygen, are brought in in ionized form by the comet nucleus. And this entire process and how it works, the discharge of the solar capacitor that keeps the comet charged on the nucleus, it doesn't just happen magically. There's an entire process, which is in that entire charging process is fundamental to the solar capacitor, which also, by the way, drives our weather. We would not have any sort of weather on Earth if it were not for this solar capacitor, which the sun puts out far more energy in terms of electrical energy than it does in terms of light energy. But of course, all of this is completely foreign to standard astronomical theory or meteorology, etc. But going back to the idea of deformation of the crust of planet Earth, and of course this happens on Mars, it happens on the other planets also that have surface crusts. When we saw the comets, was about 1997, the 21 pieces of the Schumacher-Levy 9 comet, there were 21 pieces that came in and affected the atmosphere of Jupiter and created electrical effects that were measurable from Earth. The Russians had all of their equipment tuned on these small comets and could detect the tremendous explosions that were the equivalent, some of them the equivalent of all the nuclear bombs on planet Earth going off from one of these little pieces of a comet. And so at that time, I was communicating with Russian scientists, and their comment was that this ultimately proved that the dirty snowball comet model was, it simply could not account for what we observe. And my comet model, the plasma discharge comet model, did account for literally everything we saw with these comets. And so now you can go on detail after detail after detail. But the comets that pass near Earth, the bigger ones, then have a number of effects, electromagnetic effects, gravitational effects, in the form of tidal waves in earthquakes and mountain building and change of the pole, the rotational pole, not to mention water and oil pollution, mass extinctions, and other dramatic effects. Now, the ancients talk about this, the fact that the brimstone and fire, or the ancients talk about the influx of hydrocarbons burning in the upper atmosphere, or the electrical discharges that were seen from planet Earth, basically a tornado. Remember the tornado in the Moses story extending up into the heavens? That is exactly what you would expect. The tornado is the uprushing of material, ionized material, and it spins because of the Coriolis force. It acts just like a tornado. In fact, it turns out that tornadoes and cyclones and hurricanes are all powered by the same type of electrical discharge, only there it is a discharge up to the Earth's ionosphere, not to an object that is in outer space. So all of these effects have been mentioned, and that's why, for example, when I first got my hands on the Colburn decades ago, the owners of the Colburn wanted me to read it so I could interpret the scientific part of what this said. And it was just amazing to see my plasma discharge comet model coming out in real life, the real life story describing exactly what you would expect from a large passing comet. And the ancients observed this, not only, I mean, the hundreds of different effects. For example, the trumpeting noise, the sound like a tremendous chorus of trumpets blowing. And those are the electrical discharges. And so at any rate, with this in mind, this is why I want to explain that the term crustal deformation is a better term than pole shift. Because, as I said, a pole shift would imply that, for example, say you take a globe, a model of the Earth that you have sitting on the shelf in your study, and you take that and you just juxtaposition the poles of the Earth and then spin it on a new set of axes, the entire globe would spin, the entire surface of the Earth. And that is not what happens during a passage of a large celestial object. The gravitational wave has more effect in certain regions than in others. Just like when the Earth is spinning under the moon, the tide is in a certain area. It's predominantly in a certain area, and north and south of that, it is less. East and west, it is less also. And so the main effect of this follows the path of the object that's passing by planet Earth. The end result is that the Earth's surface is deformed. It's not a perfect movement of the entire Earth's surface around a central point. There are areas that are deformed a lot more than other areas. And of course, once this wave is set up in the Earth's surface, the waves continue across the land. Now imagine this. Imagine a land wave that was 200 to 300 feet high, maybe even higher, maybe as much as 1,000 feet. And so in a 5-minute span, the Earth is rising up and down 200 feet. This is a wave that's passing underneath you. Just imagine you're out on the ocean, and you're in a boat, and this big wave comes underneath you. So you go up, the wave comes underneath you, and then you come back down. That's what happened, and that's what the ancient people describe. They're describing this. They're describing the tsunamis that follow this kind of activity. The ancient Mayans, the Popol Vuh, talks about the Quetzalcoatl, the plumed serpent god of the night sky, which was their literal interpretation of the comet Venus, the comet that eventually became the planet Venus coming by Earth, that it carried the oceans on Quetzalcoatl's back. It created land waves and created mountain ranges. So that's their figurative way of describing these events. So mountain building is, for one, not caused by plate tectonics. And when you see this happening, the interesting part of this is that if you go through the textbooks that are taught grade school, high school, university, whatever, they have nothing to do with reality. There's no way that plates simply moving around planet Earth all by themselves with no force, with no energy source, that these things could build mountains, raise this massive amount of rock, etc., tens, 20, 30,000 feet up into the air, and by two continental plates pushing sideways against each other, it's simply impossible. Absolutely impossible. So the end result is that the Earth deforms not in a consistent manner all over the planet. So there are certain areas that have much more deformation than other areas. And that's why, for example, when you're looking at coral reef movement, you have to understand that those are in the equatorial regions or near the equatorial regions, and they might not be the most affected areas. There might be areas that change very little because the new equator and the old equator are basically two planes and they're going to intersect. So the location of most movement of the equatorial plane will be in the line of the passing object, where the object passes over the Earth. Depends on where the closest approach is, all of these factors. And somebody asked me, they said, is there a way to analyze the Earth's surface for a particular, for a given close passage of a celestial object? Is it possible to determine which way the object was coming, or the time, the date, or anything like that? And the answer is no. You do not have the ability, just by looking at the physical end result, you don't have a way of going back in history and say it was on certain date or time or whatever, because the Earth is spinning on its axis, and the timing of an object coming over would cause certain damage in certain areas. The only thing you can definitely say is to give an estimate of the direction relative to the Earth, but that's relative to the surface of the Earth as the Earth spins on its axis. But given these events, they were major catastrophic events in the history of the human race. And that is something also that I keep pounding on, because standard history, if you go into textbooks, if you go into search on Google, or go into Wikipedia, if you look up mass extinctions, they do not talk about the most recent one, which is the dying off of the mastodons, saber-toothed tigers, etc. I talked about this a number of weeks ago. I dedicated a show based on a listener question of the history of mass extinctions. There were about there are six major mass extinctions in the history of the Earth. There's about 20 total, where there are minor mass extinctions, and an asteroid colliding into Earth does not constitute an activity or an event that would call us that level of damage on a worldwide basis, or mountain building, whatever. So it has to be something major, like a comet coming by. And it's very simple to say, it's very correct to say, that the Earth cannot jump up and simply do this on its own. So anyway, there's a little bit of follow-up from the interview with Mark Gaffney last week. As I said, go to my webpage, jmccsci.com, scroll down, and look at the link to the subpage for Mark Gaffney's interview from last week. Now, very rarely do I talk about the products I sell in my webpage, but I'm going to divert a little bit of time this week to talk about my water filters. Just remind you that I have the best water filter products on the planet. Just a few examples. They're the lowest price. I have free shipping. But not only that, I have the filter elements are very consistent, from the small ones up to the big ones to the whole house filters, in that they have targeted filtration. In other words, the composition of the filters is such that they target a very long list of toxins, heavy metals, volatile organic chemicals, chemicals such as chloramine, glyphosate, and they take out arsenic and fluoride in the filter itself. You don't have to have an add-on filter. That's something that everybody else, every other filter manufacturer on the planet requires, is an add-on filter just to take out fluoride and arsenic, something that is in everybody's water. If you live in Texas, more than likely you have arsenic in your water to some locations to a high degree. So filters that I'm selling, the JMCC GF filters, there's no comparison. Made in our own factory in the United States, shipped from our own factory direct to you, and you cannot buy these anyplace else. So only from my webpage, the jmccsci.com. Also, the whole house filters are available, so you can filter out all of the toxins before they go into your shower, etc. And this is one of the biggest problems that people face today, is when you go take a shower, you're taking a shower in the steam, the vapor, you're breathing in all of these harsh chemicals, chlorine, basically carcinogenic chemicals, lead. These are toxins, and you're breathing them in, and your skin is the biggest absorbing organ on your body. So your skin is absorbing all of these pollutants also. So the shower filters that you might buy on the open market, the problem with them is that they're too small. The water flow through a shower is too fast, and there's very little contact time. So they really don't take out that much in terms of toxins. That's why a whole house water filter is the best solution if you're interested in removing chemicals while you shower. Also, you know, when you go to the dryer and you're washing your clothes, you go to the dryer and there's all that lint. The reason all that lint is there is that's your clothes. It's the chlorine in the water breaking down your clothes and turning it into dust. And that's why you have that big pile of dust. Can you imagine? Where would all this dust come from in your clothes? Well, it's your clothes literally breaking down because of chlorine. So the whole house filters take that chlorine out, and you will find much less dust in your dryer when you wash and dry your clothes. So at any rate, all kinds of good things to say about my water filters. Plus, as I said, free shipping to the 48 states. We do charge extra for Hawaii and Alaska because they just charge so much to ship there. But go to the webpage, jmccsci.com, and also think about joining my paid cast. Right now I'm working on the educational program, preschool, K-12, university level, and it'll be about 100 lectures for basically education, getting back to a good old educational system. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.